I'm leaning towards the mic. Well, welcome everyone. I'm really pleased to see this many people here, and I know it's a little bit of a late hour, so thanks for coming out. I'm Erica Lehrer. I'm an assistant professor in the history department and also the sociology anthropology department here at Concordia, and I direct CEREV, which is the Center for Ethnographic Research and Exhibition in the Aftermath of Violence. And I'd just like to take a moment before we introduce our speaker to welcome you to the first talk in our CEREV series, Current Issues in Museums, Heritage, and Public Cultural Work. We're pleased to be able to bring this semester to Concordia two unique speakers. Tonight's speaker, David Pilgrim, who you'll hear about and then from shortly. And then I hope you'll also note down our next event in this same room at the same time, exactly 1 month from now. So Thursday, March 17th, when we will host historian David Scobie, who is an executive dean at the New School for Social Research in New York, for a talk entitled In Here, Out There, The Place of Scholarship in a Democracy, or Why Maurice Chevalier Came to Town. Dr. Scobie's talk will be accompanied by an exhibit about the Franco-American mill workers of Lewiston, Auburn, Maine, which will actually just be right out there in the atrium after the talk. And regarding tonight's talk, I'd just like to thank Lauren Lerner and the Art History Department for donating this wonderful space for the talk, as well as the Sociology and Anthropology Students Union, and particularly Angelina Lego, for their generous co-sponsorship of the event. And with that, I will turn over the floor to CEREV postdoctoral fellow Dr. Monica Patterson, who will introduce Dr. David Pilgrim. Just one other note, actually. We have a few, like a couple of slots left in a workshop tomorrow, a sort of relatively small group workshop with Dr. Pilgrim, where we're going to be experimenting with how one curates the kind of difficult objects he's going to be talking about tonight. If someone is really interested in coming to that, it's from 10 to noon tomorrow morning, and you could either come talk to me or to Amber Burson, who's raising her hand right there, after the talk, if you're very interested, and we can maybe work that out. So I give you Monica Patterson. Thank you.
Just to start with a little administrative detail, since I'm thinking of it, I just wanted to ask if everyone could please turn off their cell phones so we don't have any unwanted interruptions. Thank you. It truly is a pleasure for me to introduce our first speaker in CEREV's Current Issues in Museums, Heritage, and Public Cultural Work lecture series, Dr. David Pilgrim. Dr. Pilgrim is a leading expert on issues relating to multiculturalism, diversity, and race relations. A professor of sociology, he is also the founder and curator of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia, a 9,000-piece collection of racist artifacts located at Ferris State University in Big Rapids, Michigan. Dr. Pilgrim currently serves as the university's vice president for diversity and inclusion at Ferris State. I first encountered Dr. Pilgrim during a speaker series entitled Exhibiting Controversy at the University of Michigan, where I was completing my own graduate work in anthropology and history, including a certificate in museum studies. After hearing about the Jim Crow Museum, I wanted to see it for myself. African Americans have long been represented and defined in essentialized, hateful ways and on others' terms. For me, the experience of visiting the Jim Crow Museum was quite profound, as I saw how ugly, hurtful objects could lead to productive dialogue about race and racism. My visit so inspired me that I decided to write about the museum in a forthcoming volume that I co-edited with Erica Lehrer and our colleague at the University of Montreal, Cynthia Milton. And if you will pardon the shameless plug, the book is entitled Curating Difficult Knowledge, Violent Pasts in Public Places. The Jim Crow Museum insistently inserts a shameful shard of American history into view that has been systematically swept under the carpet, cast far from center, and often belittled or denied through pronouncements that racism is a thing of the past, that racist caricatures are harmlessly humorous, or, worse yet, that they merely reflect the realities of racial difference. The collection of racist memorabilia at the JCM contests such arguments with a stockpile of evidence buttressed by analysis, scholarship, and reflection. As a collection, it demands that viewers acknowledge not only the deeper historical genealogies of these images, but their centrality in both American history and contemporary life. Museums have often sought to inspire and invoke a sense of internal transformation or even sublimation, typically by using rare or exquisite objects of display that may serve as examples of society's best achievements. But what approaches should be used when confronting and displaying the hatefulness and horror of our societies? Contributing to the emergent field of curating difficult knowledge, Dr. Pilgrim's Museum helps position visitors as participants in ways that enable them to inhabit educational, social, and personal spaces that powerfully connect the Jim Crow past with the ongoing present. Reworking exhibitionary practices to more centrally integrate pedagogical methods and structured dialogue, the JCM is not a museum in the traditional sense. As you will soon learn, Dr. Pilgrim's work is an example of how we might use scholarship and dialogue to address racism in both academic and more public domains. By inviting viewer participants into its learning laboratory, the Jim Crow Museum explores the possibilities for engaging with historically contentious objects in new ways and toward new ends. And with that, I will turn over the floor to Dr. Pilgrim.
Thank you very much. And how do I get rid of that box? Where's my tech person? There he is. While he's doing that, let me tell you, first of all, for Eric and Monica, can you give them both a hand for all they've done? Monica's been a lot more helpful than Erica, but by the way, when I joke, I'll do this. That way you know I'm joking, okay, and it's okay to laugh. And I was telling Monica earlier today, thank you very much. I was telling her earlier today that if you don't have a sense of humor and you do the stuff that I do, it's not very good. Start off with a quick little story. I don't know how many of you have seen the documentary that we produced, but there's an account in there that I'd like to share with you. Can you hear me in the back? Mm-hmm. Everybody? Good. The woman who raised me, really the only mother I ever knew, she had a congenital malformation that made her unlike all but 5-10 people in the world. And I don't want to get too specific, as it were, because that would demonstrate my medical ignorance. But in effect, what happened was the cells in her feet and then legs filled up with fluid so that when she was born, her feet had this really unusual shape and were very oversized. And as she grew older, the fluid increased, and so her lower body, let's just put it this way. In the cruel world of sideshow performers, she was billed as the Elephant Girl. And I think it was December 1956, although I've been trying to hunt down the article, Ebony Magazine wrote an article about her called The Girl with Elephant's Feet. And she raised me. And I was ashamed of that. And when I found out she was not my actual mother, and by the way, it's the first time I've ever told this story in a big group. But when I found out that she was not my mother, I was actually happy, because that's the ignorance of childhood. Or at least my childhood. But I felt ashamed of being ashamed. Does that make sense? And so my master's thesis then was trying to reconcile that shame that I felt with the sense I had that I should have been loving her as the world hadn't. And so my master's thesis at The Ohio State University, which is, by the way, where God went to college. If I don't do this, it's not funny. It's just an accurate description. No, I'm serious about that. So my master's thesis then was on people who were born with a congenital malformation that was visible, permanent, and negative enough to elicit negative responses from others, or visible enough to elicit negative responses from others. And in the course of doing that research, I did a couple things. One, I ran away and joined the circus, actually a carnival. And I pretended to be, and I don't like this word, a carny, so that I could watch people when they watched the so-called, what I call, human oddities. Now, I hate the word freak. It seems to me that there, even though I'm a sociologist and I know words have no inherent meaning, that there are some words, the venom in them is so great. Words like, and forgive me, but we're adults, so I need to talk. Words like nigga and cunt and freak have that special level of repulsion and hatred in them. So I hate that word. And actually, it was years later before I realized that human oddities wasn't much of an improvement over that. But anyway, I got the job so that once I got done selling the tickets, I could walk inside. And I could watch the interaction between so-called normals and the talent. You wouldn't believe what people would say. You know, how do you have sex? Why would anybody want to be with you? Why didn't your mother hang you? Just, you wouldn't believe it. And I watched. And I stayed until they started messing with my dreams. And I had enough research data to finish my work. One of the stories I found out while I was doing my research was about a community of people who got tired of folk messing with them. You and I take our anonymity for granted. You know, unless you're a dark-skinned person, you can walk in a store in Vermont, no one pays any attention to you. You just go and get your stuff, you know what I mean? You walk in a store, you buy what you need to buy, you pay for it, you leave. If you're in Canada, you pay more for it, but you, yeah, I don't know, I'm a, you know. Wasn't equal last night at the casino when I was there. But you know, you take that for granted, I take that for granted. You take for granted that when you walk down the street, no one's gonna mock you. No one's gonna point at you and say bad things about you. You take it for granted. They couldn't take it for granted. And sometimes the resiliency of humans lifts me up. They decided that they would find a place and they would clear the land and they would build homes specific to their needs. So a woman who weighed a lot would build a home with wide doors. Does that make sense? And a home for little people, they make with shorter ceilings. You can see that. I mean, that is such a beautiful thing. And it took them 3 years to get the area right. And at the end of 3 years, they put out a sign in the front and it said, whites only. And I thought, that's it. Am I going to have to separate you two? Okay. And the first time I heard that story, I thought, why would those people of all people put out a sign that says whites only? Why? Surely of every group that has existed in this country's history, they know discrimination and prejudice and just being treated like an other more than any other group imaginable. But then the other part of me said this, why wouldn't they? They were raised in the same culture that the rest of us were raised in. And so it made all the sense that they would. I'm going to show you some images. I didn't make them. We don't make any of the images that we have. We don't show the images to titillate people, to shock people. One of the criticisms that we do get sometimes, people say, oh, you built a shrine to racism, to ugliness. No, it's not what we did. See that little room right there? Oh, and by the way, everybody clap right now on the count of three. One, two, three. All right, stop. First of all, don't ever clap for something that you don't know what you're clapping for. All right, that's number one. Number two, what you just clapped for is we just received a $250,000 gift from the DTE Foundation, and we've some other gifts in the making. And so if I were to come back here a year from now, I would be coming back here saying we've moved into the new facility and our real museum. And I can tell you, I have spent the last 2 decades trying to get that done. And when I found out that we had that foundation grant, I was happy, all right? Anyway, that little room right there only shows about 1/20th of our collection. One of the things we have to be careful about is that when we move into the much bigger place, that we don't lose that impact that you get when you walk in here. Because when you walk in there, it's overwhelming. There's just so much stuff. And you look at those pieces, and I've learned a few things. One thing I've learned is that when I'm talking in there, no one's listening. Because there's a piece talking to them. Okay? So that little room right there, and I was telling Monica and Erica, the day we move into the new place, the next day, I'm going to move the stuff we've collected on other groups. Because about 5-7 years ago, I started collecting a lot of that stuff. And I'm going to move that stuff into this room. And then the day after that, I'm going to say that this room is too small. This is one of our traveling exhibits. Do you see that piece up front? Right. Do you see that hole in him? That was made by a high-powered rifle. That's called the running nigger. And what that is it's a metal piece that people would, in their backyards, shoot. I found out about this because about once every 2 years, I would read a FBI retreat or a police officer's retreat, and some black police officers would have gotten upset because there was this activity where people were shooting at this target. And they would sue the other officers or the departments. And I kept thinking, what is the thing they're shooting at? That's the thing they're shooting at. And if you go to Google tonight and type in running nigger, you'll pull up a set of targets because those are very common. Okay. That's one of our 2 traveling exhibits. We created the traveling exhibits because not everyone's going to come to Big Rapids, Michigan. And I wanted to take the lessons of the museum beyond the campus. How many of you know the Jim Crow? How many of you heard the term? How many of you know the history behind it? How many of you think you're right? How many of you know this is a setup? All right. So Jim Crow, quit reading. It's such an obedient group. You know, I was just in El Paso. I would say something to people to do what the hell they wanted to do. Don't put that on the internet. Because people, they really like me there, so I shouldn't have said that. The people in El Paso were wonderful. All right. When I say, what was Jim Crow? What's your name, sir, with the white shirt on?
I'm on.
Okay. What was Jim Crow? That's okay. Who are you?
Sam. Jim Crow was a law that came into place after slavery was abolished, and it enforced segregation, something of that sort.
Well, not to get biblical, but as Jesus said, you are near the kingdom, but not quite there. Who knows Jim Crow? What is it? Sir, what is Jim Crow? Or what was Jim Crow?
After the Civil War, they passed all sorts of segregation laws and called them the Jim Crow laws. That's my...
Okay. So Jim Crow was what then?
A series of laws.
All right. Anybody? Yes.
This couple.
What's your name?
David.
Well, you know what? You have to be right. Even the guy you're bringing here next month, his name's David, right? You guys have a David thing here. Is that what it is? David, sir, explain to people what Jim Crow is.
Well, as you have, like, Daddy Rice, was a he was like a blackface minstrel who was actually a white performer. Uh-huh. And he came up with this character, Jim Crow.
Okay.
And then it turned, and then they had these kind of like music sheet work and stuff like that. Uh-huh. And then it gradually turned into a set of unofficial laws.
Okay. Now that's the best answer I've heard so far. All right, here's where like almost all history books are wrong. The reason I say this is because they disagree with me. Right. Jim Crow was first a slur. All right. Now, that you don't read that in any books. However, if you go back far enough, you'll hear people referring to blacks as Jim Crow. Okay, it was like, it wasn't as bad as nigga, but it was like coon or darky or something, all right? Then you had a white performer who, and I don't know what story is correct. Some people say he saw a young man who had problems with his leg. Some people say he saw an old guy who didn't get around well, whatever. But he saw something in some black person and decided to mock it and create a stage persona. Okay? He didn't just pull the name out of his head, though, as people claim he did. So he took this name that was floating out there, he gave it to his stage character. We see people still doing that today, right? He then became famous nationally and internationally, performing this buffoon-like character, right? Jim Crow. Then black people in the main started associating Jim Crow with things that put them down. So, for example, you hear W.B. Du Bois saying he doesn't want to go down south because he'll be what? Jim Crowed. So it was a slur, then a stage name. Then it became a name not just for the laws, but for everything that put black people down. More than the laws. Laws were the one of the things most evident to us. But Jim Crow also was like this. Give me your hand. I couldn't have done that under Jim Crow because I'm holding the hand of a person who might be presumed as white. Okay? Because I can't. Well, what did you say again?
No,
say it again.
Jim Harris, no.
Okay, because I think that's a good answer. I don't know. I move forward, she moved back. Years have been unkind, but hey, we do what we can. All right. But anyway, I couldn't have lit her cigarette. Okay? If she was dropping her bags, I couldn't have picked them down. I couldn't have shown pity for her. Because pity implies that I'm what? Superior to her. Okay? If we got to a street light at the same time, I had to let the white person go first. When I was in college, which was not 100 years ago, though it feels like it, but when I was at Jarvis Pearson College, my teachers, my African-American teachers, told us stories. For example, I'll give you one. Dr. O.C. Nix, bless his heart, gone on to his reward now. Dr. O.C. Nix loved a new car. Oh, there's a stereotype in there somewhere, I'm guessing. Loved a new car. And the bigger car, the better. Had to have a new car. Not a great thing for a black person to be riding around in the deep rural South in a new car in the 1940s and 50s. So what did he and other blacks like him do? They always had a new car and a chauffeur's hat. So that if they were stopped, what do you think they did with the chauffeur's hat? You think they flung it out the window? No, what did they do with it? They put it on. Give you one other quick example. There were towns where blacks could not drink Coke. Coke was a white man's drink. Okay? That does sound funny now, doesn't it? Okay? I'll give you one last one. I remember my grandparents used to always know their waist sizes. Now, we all lie about our waist size. But they used to really know their waist. And the people would sit around, and there was this obsessiveness about their clothing sizes. And a person would say, like myself, 32, 30, I'm shrinking. But the person would go, I'm a 32, 36, or I'm a 34, 34, or whatever. You know why they knew their clothes, why their pant size? Because they weren't allowed to try on pants in a store, because if I tried on the same pants that he tried on, that implied what? Equality. And, I don't get Freudian, a kind of intimacy, right? So Jim Crow was all of that. It wasn't just the laws. And I just gave you that. So most of us have seen these type signs. And in our museum, we have more signs than you could imagine. Actually, we just purchased a white-only, colored-only, two fountains. And they're not really going to work for us. Because the person who found them, and they're not reproductions, the person who found them hidden away where they'd never been used. And so the black one, the colored one, looks as good as the other one. I'd have to pee in the colored one, make it all, I'm trying to make a point, okay? I'd have to really do nasty things to it in order for it to look authentic. So, but anyway, we have lots of those signs. And this is actually the name of a play now. I don't know how many of you are aware of this. I've told you like 8 things, and every time I go, do you know this? You go, no, I don't know that. Okay, so do you know this sign? Yes, just say yes. Okay, good. This is actually the name of a play, and it originated out of North Carolina. It's a very, very powerful play. And the reason I like this sign is because it demonstrates that injustice is rarely perpetrated against a single group. It's just rare. to have that happen. And so it was sort of common to see, like with the Jim Crow laws, that they would say Negro and Chinese, or they would say Negro and Mexican, or they would say Negro and Jew, or whatever. Okay? And this sign right here happens to be in one of the traveling exhibits. Jim Crow was also about poverty. Got to tell you a quick story. I'm going to tell you stories till I bore you. When I was little growing up, we did not have what he called landfills. We had dumps. Which, and in my mind, there is a distinction. We had dumps. And I grew up in Mobile, Alabama. Actually, it parts Mobile, then in Pritchett, which is poorer than Mobile and more thickly segregated than Mobile. There was a dump that was no farther than from where I am, 4 or 5 blocks up the street. And it smelled, I mean, but here's the thing. People lived on the dump. I mean, they lived there. And I was a 5, 6-year-old kid. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world, that people were living on a dump. Now, years later, as a sociologist, it hits me that at the time, and you can go back and check what the proportion would have been, we would have been 5-6% of the world's population controlled, and at that time, probably 45% of the world's wealth, and in the richest country, in the city on the top of the hill, you got people living on a dump. Well, Jim Crow was not just about the segregation, it was also about poverty, a thick poverty. And when I go to Alabama now, and I go to Pritchett now, I am often just surprised, even to this day, how those patterns of poverty just became perpetrated across generations, and how thick and defeating that poverty is. One quick poverty thing. I'm sitting in a restaurant one day, and 2 men are talking, and I'm listening. 2 reasons. I'm a sociologist, and I'm nosy. So I'm listening to what they're saying. And they got nice suits on, those Brooks Brothers suits, you know what I mean? And nice $600, $700 shoes. I mean, just, and they look pretty. And they're complaining, and their conversation goes something like this. If you are poor in America, it's all on you. This is the richest country in the world. If you're poor, it's on you. You're lazy. You lack ambition. You lack discipline. It's all on you. This is the land of opportunity. Milk and honey. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, but the woman who's cooking your food right now is poor in the kitchen. She's cooking for you. And the person who's upstairs making your bed is poor because they make poverty wages. Not because they're not working. And they're cooking for you. You're not cooking for yourself. And the person who fixed your roof last summer was poor. And when you needed illicit sex, that was in all likelihood a person who was poor. I mean, it's all a matter of how you look at it, isn't it? That's not the way you look at things, Erica?
I have a friend in Toronto who does volunteer work for the United Way, and he's from Jamaica originally, and he says, we went downtown to the fundraising initiation of fund for the United Way, the TD Center in the downtown business core, and as we walked in, he says to me, you know, this is the pyramid scheme down there, you know, pyramid, you know, hierarchies, you know, people at the top controlling.
Okay. All right. Jim Crow was also about violence. And we don't like talking about lynching. As a matter of fact, when I ask people what is lynching, they always say the same thing, it was hanging somebody. And really what lynching is what? It's just a what? Public killing. That's all it is, public killing. And so you could have been burned to death. Or you could have been, how many of you have seen Without Sanctuary, the traveling, you get my point? There are all kind of ways to lynch a person. It could be, I mean, you know, I just got done arguing with some black nationalists because they're like, you said the word picnic. And that comes from the lynching where they'd say pick a nigga and they lynch him. And I was like, okay, that's not true. The word picnic existed before the blacks were lynched in this country. But what you have is a little bit of the truth. The truth is that lynchings often took on a picnic-like quality. A, you know what I mean? A fun 4th of July type atmosphere. Yes, that's true. That part is true. We had about 4,000 people that we know, blacks that we know were lynched during the Jim Crow period. But if you watch Eyes on the Prize, you know Eyes on the Prize, the documentary? There is a poignant line in there when they talk about Goodman, Cheney, and Swerner, the three civil rights workers that were killed down in the name of the city, Paradise, Mississippi. It's like we got this poor street in Grand Rapids called Wealthy Avenue. It's like somebody's trying to be funny, you know what I'm saying? All right? But when they looked for those three boys, when they looked for them, one of the people they interviewed, this is why you got to love oral history and why you got to get people's stories before they die. Because one of the people who was there said this right here, when they drug the rivers looking for them, they found many unnamed boys. Now, first of all, everybody's got a name. But I get the point they were making. And those didn't show up on any lynchings. Okay? So Jim Crow could not have worked without violence and the threat of violence. I went out to Stanford. A young man stood up and he says, Dr. Pilgrim, I can put, at the time we had like 4,000 pieces, I can put one word on all 4,000 pieces. I said, what's that one word? He says, propaganda. And I thought, wow, that's actually true. Up until that point, when I thought of propaganda, I thought of it in like old grainy film. Or like during the Vietnam War when leaflets would come down from airplanes. I thought of propaganda like that, or a guy standing on top of a soapbox or a street corner and proselytizing the world. I thought of it in a sociological sense. You know, information disseminated, designed to persuade you. But I thought of it as mostly literature. I never thought of an ashtray as propaganda, or a bank, or a toy, or a postcard as propaganda. And yet that's what these objects were. You see, when you see a piece of sheet music like this, it's propaganda. Because it says something about the people that are being depicted. These objects both shape and reflect our attitudes about people. They both shape and reflect our attitudes. And so when you look at an image like this, you think, would you want these people living next door to you? One of my students came by one day and she said, I have a thing I want to give you. And it's very expensive, but we don't want any money for it. That's right up my alley. And I was like, well, what is it? And she pulls out this 1896 print. And I looked at this and I said to her, I think you need to know this is really worth a lot of money. Not just worth a lot of money. And she said, we understand that. And I knew her family not to be especially wealthy. And I don't encourage anybody to sell any of this stuff, and I've never sold a piece in my life, but I just felt like I should be honest. Now, the average dealer I've met over the years, I'll buy it as cheap as I can because I don't like paying a penny for it. But she says, no, we talked about it, and we want to donate this to the museum. And I says, okay. This right here, this image, which this imagery has shown up on postcards, prints, T-shirts, it's been reproduced more times than I could tell you. And what it says is so much. I mean, just think, if you're illegal alien, unless you're a Romulan or a Cleon or you don't know what I'm talking about, you don't watch TV. Some of you, do we have any Trekkies here? Do we have any?
E.T.
Huh? E.T. Yeah, unless you're E.T., then you're not an illegal alien. That is just the most bizarre. And it really freaks me out when people do that with Mexican Americans, because unless I was really sleeping in every one of my classes, they're Native Americans too. It's San Francisco, San Jose. It's not Millertown, right? Anyway, what this says then is these people have no parents. It says they have no modesty. it says that there's a kind of thick poverty about them. It says they are a litter. That they are not as evolved. You know, it's lonely at the top of the food chain, and they're not at the top. And if you multiply images like this thousands and hundreds of thousands of times, then people don't see them, and they see them all the time. And this right here, for those of you, this is actually, you know, we used to be, you hear sometimes people say, well, what we need in the criminal justice system is to go back to corporal punishment. Well, we had corporal punishment in the U.S. Actually, most countries did, or many countries did. And that was a poll in Delaware. And the unofficial name of it was Red Hannah. Why do you think they called it Red Hannah? Because of the blood. Now, you know enough about America to know whether it's Delaware, Dover, Delaware, or Flint, Michigan, to know that minorities and poor whites are going to disproportionately be hugging that poll. Do you know enough about America's history to know that?
Yes.
Okay. And that poll was used until the 1950s. And there's a story about that poll that I'm going to come back and tell you at the end, but I just want you to remember that image. Can you do that for me? Okay. Good. Does everybody know Agatha Christie? Okay. Does everybody know what a gollywog is? How many of you know what a gollywog is? Raise your hands. Wow, we actually have some people. Raise your hands. That's good. Did any of you have one? I'm not going to beat you up if you had one. That's fine. Gollywog, in some ways, is like the teddy bear of Europe, actually. Okay. And I could say something really bad. I won't say it. But anyhow, there's a long story. If you would please go to the website on all the caricatures that we discuss, Mammy, Tom, Coon, Sambo, whatever, we write articles about them, and so there's one on the gollywog. But the reason I wanted to show it here is because here you have what was a mainstream book by a very popular author, and in its history, the name changed to eventually be, and then there were none. And so there's an interesting dynamic about how do you confront racist imagery and names, and this book is a part of that. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that after. How many of you remember Little Black Sambo? Anybody? I almost had, raise your hands, only the people older than me, is that what it is? Again, in the case of Little Black Sambo, what you have is, that's right, was there something I said? That's it. Let me ask you, though, who says they remember Little Black Sambo? Raise your hand. I love it. What do you remember about him?
Turning to butter.
But, you know, here's the thing, though. He was a clever little boy. Remember that? And he was walking somewhere, and a tiger saw him. Remember the story? And the tiger wanted to eat him. Now, that's significant. We have so many objects in a Jim Crow museum where blacks are food. Either food for alligators or food for tigers or lions. Again, that's a way of saying you're not at the top of the food chain, if you forgive the pun. And so Little Black Sambo had like a nice coat and a nice hat and a nice umbrella. And so he bargained with tigers, right? Says, well, if you don't eat me, I'll give you this right here. Another, I think it was some version, there's another tiger, whatever. And he says, if you don't eat me, I'll give you this umbrella. If you don't eat me, whatever. And then he got really, really clever. And what he did was, he started running and having a tiger. This is stupid. There's no tigers in Africa, right? Unless somebody just brought one over there yesterday. I mean, tigers in India, right? But I can tell you how that happened. Anyhow, the point is that the tigers are chasing him around the tree, right? And you're going faster and faster and faster and faster. And finally, he runs so fast that the tigers turn into butter. And then he takes the butter home, and his mammy, whose name was Mumbo, makes pancakes. And now Little Black Sambo is as happy as a runaway slave because he's got all these pancakes, right? Christopher Bing, one of this country's great illustrators, a few years back came out with a new version of Little Black Sambo. And in his, I mean, when I say one of this country's great illustrators, I'm not being flippant. He is a talented artist, okay? And what he did was he took away the racial names, Black Mambo, Black Jumbo, and Black Sam. Well, I don't know if he changed Sambo's name or not. Just changed it to Sambo, maybe. He changed the names, and he redrew the pictures so they weren't as caricatured as they had been in the U.S. stories. Because the U.S. stories took the Indian story, you know, and added all racist baggage. And not carry-on baggage, a big suitcase baggage. And then he comes out with this book. And I criticized him. And here's the thing. For Christopher Bean, Little Black Sambo represented him spending time with his father. It represented the happiest point in his life. A little boy sitting on his father's lap, having his father read him a story. That's what it represented for him. And what I said to him was, is that for other people, it represents slurs and anti-black caricatures. And he just couldn't get it in his head that I couldn't get it in my head that for him, it was not racist. And we argued on NPR, and finally I said this to him. Here's a thought. Why not just write a new story? Why not just, instead of soaping up, sanitizing some old racist story, why not just tell a new story? The reason I'm showing this can is because all the objects in our museum are everyday objects. Again, ashtrays, postcards. I think this right here, I'm not sure if it says barbecue sauce in here. It doesn't look like you'd put barbecue sauce in there. It looks like you'd have it as a gas can or a water can or something, doesn't it? Yeah, you're thinking the way I am. Doesn't look like a barbecue. But the other reason I put it on there is because there was a chain of stores called Coon Chicken Inn. How many of you heard of Coon Chicken Inn? Okay, good. And when you drove there, and they were in Seattle and Spokane and Portland. Not Mobile and Biloxi and Pensacola. Okay, these were enlightened cities out west. And when you drove down the street, the big blackface head, which looked similar to that, was so big that you walked in through his mouth, right? And they found the blackest people they could to work in there. They had minstrel shows in there, and their specialty was fried chicken and watermelon. Coon Chicken Inn went out of business in the 1970s. And I purchased from the grandson of Coon Chicken Inn, a lot of the photographs and like the personal artifacts of the family. Oh, one quick watermelon story. We get stories every month. We try to answer them on question of the month. And I get questions all the time like, why do black people like watermelon so much? First of all, how many of you like watermelon? Raise your hands. Okay. Well, that answers that question right there. But here's the interesting thing. There's actually a National Watermelon Association that does consumer research. Well, I guess they would do consumer research. And what they've discovered, the last two studies I've seen, which are the only two I've seen that they've done, is that blacks are underrepresented as watermelon eaters. Underrepresented. Whites are proportionately represented. And Mexican-Americans are overrepresented as watermelon eaters. That is the first time in my life I wanted to French kiss a researcher. First time in my life. What was Lyndon Baines Johnson's slogan? Go all the way with LBJ. Lyndon Baines Johnson, when he ran for president in, what was that, 1964? Was it 64? Go all the way with LBJ. And this right here, what is that object? It's not an ashtray, it's a what? It's a license plate. Again, an everyday object, propaganda. In this case, insulting blacks, black women, Democrats, and I guess presumably LBJ. This fits into the stereotype of blacks as unusually good at entertainment. Tell you, this is a fascinating, you know, that Princeton, the social distance studies that they do, and also the stereotype studies that they've done in Princeton over the last 70, 80 years. One of the things you'll discover if you look at the studies in a longitudinal way is that the same stereotypes that we now have of African Americans, Puerto Ricans, and some other groups, we used to have of groups like the Irish and Italians. And it's just fascinating now that some of those groups have those stereotypes on these other groups. And it's because when you don't know history, it's like walking in traffic. That's that image when I was talking about Coon Chicken Inn. Can you imagine driving? And that's not even the biggest one. I mean, there were a couple of the heads that were big enough. And when we build the new museum, we're recreating that head. So you have to walk through there so that I can tell the story of Coon Chicken Inn. And I'm also going to have like a living room in there where you see all the stuff that would have been in the living room and a kitchen and the stuff would have been in there. And this year, you're going to walk right through his mouth. That's too much text, so. And put that back because I'm trying to talk to you with all that text up there. Those notes are for me. They don't involve you at all. So when I put text up there, just talk amongst yourselves. No, don't do that. But one of the things I hear when I travel around, people say this. If you just stop talking about race, racism will go away. Have you heard that before? Yeah, that doesn't even make stupid sense, okay? The reality is this. We talk about race all the time. We talk about it in our living rooms, in restrooms, in corridors, dinner tables. We talk about it in places where our ideas don't get challenged. What we resist are sitting in spaces and talking with other people about race. And I think when someone said to me recently, they were like, I'm just sick and tired of talking about this stuff. I thought we were done with this. And I thought to myself, well, let's make an analogy. Would we ever get to the point in any culture where we say, oh, we've answered questions about men and women, no more discussions about that. We're done with that. We answered that in the 70s. Isn't that stupid? The idea, it's almost this, I mean, I get it, especially in the U.S. I mean, in the U.S., we are such, we like look at history. Because, you know, folks will say, well, you know, you live in the past. Like, if ever there was a culture that lived in the past, it's the U.S. I mean, every time I turn around, we're celebrating something that happened 50, 100, 200 years ago. I mean, it's a brand new country celebrating history like it's been around forever. You know? But it's all happy history. See? The stuff where we can send out fireworks to. But when we are asked to be mature and to trust the triumph of dialogue and have good, solid, honest, even painful discussions about the past. See, that's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for the culture, but it's also individually uncomfortable. And that's what that museum does better than most, is that it creates a place where you have to, where no one beats you up. I was telling Monica today, one thing I've learned is this, and I was going to say this later, but I'll say it now. When people come into that museum and they say something, either trying to be funny or trying to be the class clown, or just say something that I personally find offensive, I don't crush them. Because I have learned that when you crush someone, you can no longer teach them. And not only can you no longer teach them, you can't teach the other people that watch you crush them. And you haven't helped anything. And the truth of the matter is, if you ask people to talk, if you create a safe space for people to talk, they're going to talk. So we talk about race, and we talk about other isms. Before you come into the museum, I ask people to watch Marlon Riggs's Ethnic Notions or the documentary that we raised. I would tell you that I think Marlon Riggs was one of the deepest people that country produced, and he is one of the many people we've lost to AIDS in the U.S., and just a talented documentarian. Our documentary creator, brilliant. And what that documentary does, it just sets the context for us. So I'm gonna show you what, let's pretend we're in the museum. First of all, if we were in the museum, I wouldn't be doing all this talking. That's number one. But I'm gonna ask you, when you see this picture, what is it you see? Yes?
I think it's the trying to portray Rastafarian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the red, yellow, and green.
Okay.
Keep off the grass and the dreadlocks.
Okay. What is it you see?
Tasmanian devil.
It has what?
The Tasmanian Devil.
The Tasmanian Devil. What is it you see? Am I on your way and you can't see?
Rolling Stones.
The Rolling Stones. Okay. And why is it you see that? What is that?
Isn't that tongue from the Rolling Stones?
Oh, you mean like Mick Jagger's tongue?
I don't know. That,
you mean Kiss? I don't know. Mick Jagger has the lips. The guy from Kiss. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. That's what you see. That's good.
See, she sees it too.
You see that
same
thing?
I don't know if I see that, but it's true. There's a Rolling Stone.
There we go.
Okay. Oh, that's good. That's good. So, well, okay, that's good. What is it you see?
I may need new glasses, but I also see potentially Stars of David in the eyeballs, maybe because we just came from the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and there's a lot of black and Jewish mixtures in these stereotypes.
Okay. So what is it you see? Sir, I was picking on you earlier. What is it you see? Yes?
I see the smoking of the, what I think is a joint, maybe stereotypes.
The smoking of what?
What looks to me like a joint.
What's a joint? Marijuana. You go, the smoking of a joint. What do you mean? What's a joint?
Marijuana.
You scream joint, you whisper marijuana. All right, that's fine. Like we didn't know what marijuana's in a joint. Like a joint's just a thing opposite, you know, separate from marijuana. All right, yes?
He's painted white face.
Oh, wow. Huh. Or something, yeah, okay. What is it you see? Yeah, yeah, what is it you see?
Like fangs. And a
fangs.
Dog.
Like a dog? Okay. What is it?
A dog or a wolf?
A dog or a wolf? Okay, yes.
He's swearing
with
the finger.
He's swearing with the finger. What does that mean?
He's it means, being rude.
Yes, he's being rude to people, summarily dismissing people. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Muscles.
Muscles. What else?
It also kind of has like a criminal element to it, like kind of this anti-authority.
Anti-authority? Of course, now you don't have to be criminal to be anti-authority, right? But maybe both of those things, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else see something? Yes.
Dementia.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Something about the pants.
The what?
The pants.
The pants. Okay.
The shorts. Right.
They're shorts. Okay.
He has no shirt on.
Has no shirt on. Okay.
Barefoot.
Okay. Yes.
He's very human hands and feet. Very inhuman face.
Okay, all right. Can we find anything else in that picture? Yes?
There's a sign that says, keep on grass. He's smoking grass and saying, fuck you.
Well, thank you for the sociological analysis. I like to keep it professional here. That's good, that's good. All right, that's right, yes.
I'm into Eastern philosophy and spirituality. You can, depending on what kind of consciousness you're at, you can project anything you want onto it. So whatever you choose.
Well, that's actually a brilliant point, because the reality is that's going to be true for everybody who comes in and everything they see, right? Yes. Anyone else see something else?
It's brown skin.
Brown skin? Yes.
Marijuana growing in the background?
Marijuana growing in the back? What else?
The sign says keep on grass.
Okay.
You think you keep off the grass.
Okay.
Yes.
Unusual. Yes?
It's a t-shirt.
It's a t-shirt. Yeah, that's how I wanted someone to also get to that. That it's a t-shirt. Because what do we with t-shirts?
We wear
them. Right? We wear a t-shirt. Now, here's the point again. It's an everyday object with all kind of meanings. And what I hear folks say is this. First of all, they say, I have no sense of humor, which is crazy. I am the funniest person I've ever met in my life. Why? I am hilarious, okay? But I laugh when I'm by myself. I have fun by myself. The point I'm trying to make is this, though. Can't a thing be both funny and offensive? Of course it can. Those are not mutually exclusive categories. Can a thing be sexist and erotic? Absolutely. None of these are mutually exclusive categories. And actually, humor, if this is humor for someone, can become a very pernicious way to spread racist ideas, can it? Absolutely. Again, yeah, it's a t-shirt. And I literally bought this off a person's body. Bought it off their body. Had to have it. Fort Myers, Florida. Was at a flea market looking for stuff. Saw this on a guy's body and just walked up to him and said, I'll give you $10 for the shirt. So I'm not going to give you $10 for my shirt. I says, well, let's try this right here. You pick out a shirt from over there, I'll pay for that shirt, and then I'll give you $10 for a shirt you have on. So it cost me like, I don't know, $20 for the whole thing. But I've gotten more than $20 worth of educational use out of it. I got to tell you this. Now, it's in Myrtle Beach. See that image right there? That, and you sort of helped me make this point right here. A lot of the traditional anti-black American caricatures, the coon, the beast, the savage, the brute, and the like, now those caricatures and the stereotypes that accompany them and the physical characteristics associated with those caricatures are now being placed on, quote, West Indian Africans. Okay? Same, it just morphed over. And we're going to do this exercise at the workshop tomorrow, so don't look at that. So what have I learned? First of all, when I first started out, I had a huge fro. I mean, just, how many of you remember the movie Hair? Anybody remember Hair? I had more hair than anybody in the movie Hair. When my hair was braided, it touched my waist, and I'm not lying, okay? I have pictures. It's like now when you get to a certain age, you gotta go, I have photographs, okay? I have photographs. So I've lost my hair. The little hair I have left is gray. But in that 30 years, what have I learned? Okay, and here are a couple things. The first one is this right here, that I have to be careful that I'm not too detached. Because when I look at the most horrific thing, for me, I've seen it. I collected it. I purchased it. I negotiated it with someone. I argued about it. I already got angry about it. I've already dealt with it. And now it's been sitting on a shelf for 23 years. I've discussed it. I've pulled it apart. I've asked many, many groups of people to look at it and tell me what they see. Okay? And for some people, it's the first time they're doing it. And so I have to be vigilant and remind myself at all times that it's not my first time. And this is one of the big lessons, and I alluded to this earlier. If you create a safe space for people to talk about difficult pieces, they're going to say some stuff you don't want to hear. That's just a fact. That's one of the reasons why every public museum in this country keeps a lot of their difficult stuff downstairs in storage or across town somewhere in storage, because they don't feel like they have the people trained to do what the museum claims it wants to do, which is to create safe spaces for dialogue. Every museum I know, and more and more of them are becoming little mini quasi-college classrooms, aren't they? Every one of them that I see claims that what they really want to do is create spaces where people can talk openly and honestly. Well, the fact of the matter is, and I'm not putting down people, but the fact of the matter is that if you do that with a crowd of any size, you're going to have people say things that are not progressive. And if you're really interested in dialogue, you got to start where people are. You got to start where they are. And this is something the docents that we have struggle with, because my docents want to correct people over and over again. They want to do what I'm doing tonight. They want to preach. They want to set the record straight. And some of that is just cathartic. And that's one of the, when we do our meetings, we talk about it, a lot of it is just personally cathartic. They want to feel better. I mean, it's not showing a piece that says nigger on it is not the same as showing just a doll. It's different. It's different. Or a tile. This is something, it took me a long time to figure this out. Just and none of this is rocket science. Once it hits you, you know, you would think, given what slavery was, and I'll tell you, if you ever want to know what slavery, I'll give it to you. Like, let me start with that. I was down in New Orleans. I'm going to be done here in a minute. Give me a little bit of time. I came all the way here, so you might as well let me talk. I'm down in New Orleans. They have a slave tour, but you know, a slave tour. And so you pay like $10 and they give you a slave tour. And I'm looking at the brochure, and it's all these big mansions, you know, the old Gone with the Wind. I don't know nothing about birds and no bacon, you know, that's silliness, right? And it's got this fictional image of Mammy and all this other stuff. And I'm like, this is not what slavery was. I said, if you want to do a real tour of slavery, go to that guy's house over there and give him one 14-year-old girl. And let her skin be yellow or red and let her be skinny. By the way, you don't have to be a genius to figure out there weren't a lot of fat or overweight black people doing slavery. Does that make sense? And there weren't a lot of blacks in any circumstance in positions of authority over whites. It happened rarely because the institution lasted so long. So I said to the person, why don't you just take me to that guy's house? And nobody would pay for that. Well, of course they wouldn't pay for that. They got this fictional image of Mammy, this Gone with the Inn, Gone with the Inn, that's a Freudian slip, this Gone with the Wind image. Okay? But let me tell you what slavery really would have been. It would have been this right here. Me being able, legally, politically, socially, culturally, any way you could imagine, to do whatever I want to her. I mean, just reduce it to, just skip all the other stuff. And it would mean every major societal institution, officially and unofficially, sanctioning me doing whatever I wanted to do. It would be complete and absolute power backed by every major societal institutions that manifested itself in me being able to do whatever I wanted to do with her or him. Okay, and what do you think I'd be doing? Okay, I'd be doing exactly what humans have always done when they've had complete and absolute authority and the backing of every major societal institution. I'd be abusing them. That's all it was. Multiplied hundreds of thousands of times. Is that too simplistic for a scholarly group? I've also learned this, that the objects that have this racist piece, this like use the N-word, or that have extreme caricatures, they don't lead to great conversations. Because everybody looks at them, whether they're conservative or liberals, and they go, that's messed up. That's wrong. And it's like, well, there's no conversation to follow that. Right? Does that make sense? But objects like this one, and people look at it and go, well, you know, I don't know where the lines are. Those are the pieces that lead to the best discussions. And remember, the purpose of the museum, the only purpose of the museum, is to facilitate discussion. It doesn't have to be a racist object. I get emails all the time. Someone says to me, is this racist right here? I'm like, I don't know. If you're asking me, does it offend me? I can answer that. If you're asking me, do I think it would offend others? I can answer that. But for us, an object does not have to be, quote, racist or pass some racist test. What it has to do is help us facilitate discussions about race, race relations, and racism. And this one does it. As a matter of fact, it does it better than some of the other objects. I didn't even know about masks and stuff. One day, I live in Rockford, and we describe ourselves as an especially proud community. And I don't mean that in a good way. I know I'm going to get flack from that if you're showing this somewhere. But it's the case. And every year, because the neighborhood houses are big, we get lots of cars from other cities that come and park to trick-or-treat in our area, okay? Which is smart. Okay, that's smart. I don't blame the people. But I never noticed for a long time until some kids would come by with blackface on and mask on. I was like, where'd you get that mask? Halloween USA, Partyland USA, you know, these stores that pop up in September the 25th and close on November the 1st. And so I start going to these stores, and I was like, oh my goodness, there are more racial and sexist stereotypes in here than any place other than porno or the comedy stage. Like, how did I not know this? And I said this to my students once, and they were like, well, of course there's horrible masks in there. It's Halloween. And my answer was yes, but it's the exaggerating of the features of the peoples of color that make them monstrous. That's different. Doesn't that make sense?
But there is also exaggerations of features of white people, like hags and sluts and whatever.
Yes.
You have it in gay, yes. Any kind of people. all kind of exaggerations.
Yes.
If and I wear a white woman's mask, old woman, would it be offensive to older people?
I think it should be if you're asking me my opinion. And I will answer you and say this right here, and I'm almost there, that once I started about 7 years ago collecting objects that defame women and the elderly and others, you're absolutely right. When I would go in store, do you have Spencer's here in Canada? You know what I'm talking about, Spencer's, though, the store? Okay, now I'm on my own. All right, but when I go in Halloween stores and like, yes, I would find those pieces. And yes, I do find them offensive. But more important than whether or not I find them offensive, I find them useful to, for purposes of discussion about stereotyping.
You know, I think it comes down, you know, the Bible says, judge not. I mean, it really comes down to that. I mean, it's very simple, but I've learned that the hard way.
Okay.
Suspend judgment. I mean, Buddha taught that, you know, all the spiritual masters.
Okay. Feel like I'm in Harlem again. This is good. This is, all right. What I wanted to show you here was, like, one of the things we say is that every object in the museum is still being made, or all the images are still being made. Sometimes they just change a little bit. And so here you have a sign from the 1920s, and you have a video game. What is that, PSP? What is that up there?
Yeah.
And you can see, this person is not even creative. This is basically
plagiarism.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is from a website called slapthathole.net. And what this is you can't see it, but he hits a white woman, and she screams or yells, depending on how hard he hits her. But this is what I want you to do if you ever get a chance. I don't want you necessarily to watch this, but if you did watch this video, and then go back and look at the senatorial race in Tennessee, not this past election, but the one before that, and look at the woman, listen to the woman, and listen to her voice, and it's a ripoff of the white woman that was used in the campaign against the black candidate. Okay? And when you see it, you'll go, okay. By the way, you know, I think education works best if we suspend judgment at the door, generally. You know, but when people come to my lectures, what I always tell them is do the opposite. Assume I'm lying. Assume I'm just pulling stuff out of my ear, and then just go and check things and see. But don't treat your other teachers like that. With every other class you take, suspend judgment at the door. The most common response we have is a kind of reflective sadness. And I was telling someone today that if it stops there, we failed. If that's where it ends, we haven't done our job. This, again, is a T-shirt. And again, these objects, they tell us about what's going on in a culture. If you look at the, can you give me about 5 more minutes? Is that okay? What's time we got? Do I have, are we okay? Okay, all right, good. If you look at the date or the, can you see the city down here? See that? What city is that?
Yeah,
I'm not picking on them, but I tell you, there's a southern part of me that always thinks it's good when it's not from the south, because a lot of times when we see stuff, we go, oh, you know, that's another thing from Alabama. You know, that's something else. And people hear me use words like hey it, or I iron my clothes, and they know I'm from the south. But when I see that right there, what it tells me is that racism did not just permeate the south. That it was a kind of national phenomenon. And it remains. The other thing I think when I see this is, who helped him make that sign? You know? I have a theory. This is a bizarre theory. This is my theory about the whole birth certificate thing. My theory is that there are Americans who don't believe Hawaii is a state. Okay, that was a joke. This whole us versus them piece. This is on more and more T-shirts. And by the way, I'm not one of these people that doesn't believe that the U.S. is more democratic than it was in years past, more egalitarian. But the fact is that a smaller number of people, because of the internet, can spread a lot of ideas the same way it used to take a lot of small-minded people to spread those ideas. So When I was in high school, I first read this quote. How many of you are familiar with this quote? First time I read it meant nothing to me. And in my collecting career, I passed objects that defame women all the time, never collected them. I passed objects that defame gays, never collected them. That defame Jews, that defame poor whites, never collected them. I passed them by because that's not what I was collecting. And then about 7, 8 years ago, I read that quote and really read it and decided, you know what? Even though I started a Jim Crow museum, it's time to broaden the approach. This right here, do you have wall marks up here?
Yep.
All right, well, good. I noticed two things about this. One is it's 1682, which means it's accessible to most people financially. Does that make sense? It's cheap. Secondly, I showed this right here to an honors group in Michigan, the best and brightest students from Michigan, including the University of Michigan. And I'm an Ohio State, I have to get that in. And I asked them, how many of you find, we were in a cabin for a whole weekend, and we were studying this, and I passed the actual object around. And I said, how many of you find this offensive? And everybody, except one or two, because there's a maverick in the group. You got to love that, right? Most people in there, most of these 19, 20-year-olds raised their hands and said, we find this offensive. And I said, how many of you find it racist? And only about half of them raised their hands. And I was a little surprised. And I said, well, what would it take to make it racist? And they said, make it black. I'd give you a whole lecture on what Asians and Asian Americans experienced in our country, in the U.S. It's brutal. Although there's a fascinating history about whites who voluntarily went to the internment camps, for example, with Japanese Americans. That's a great history. When I told my friend Clayton Rye, who helped me do the documentary Jim Crow's Museum, that I wanted to start collecting objects that defame women because we need to tell those stories, he asked me the most profound question, which was, where do you start? And where would you finish? His point being what? It's just everywhere. And I'll tell you this by way of a little bit of activism, because I don't buy the whole pure sociology, applied sociology, false dichotomy. For me, you can be a solid sociologist using good methodology and have as your end to improve this world. Well, so here'll be a little activist part of me, and that is this. Don't ever let anybody take your voice. Any situation where it takes courage to speak, there's something wrong with the situation. And I say it again so you hear me. Any situation where it takes courage to speak, there's something wrong with the situation, not the speaker. This is one of those images that I passed over years ago, but it presented itself to me again. I was in New Orleans, and there was a T-shirt that had, at the time, I don't know, she wasn't Senator Clinton at the time, but it had, she was First Lady Clinton, and it had her with what appeared to be a male genitalia. And you don't have to be a Freudian or a sociologist to realize that what that's really saying is that she's violating the script. She's acting like a what? Like a what?
Man.
A man. And that doesn't that parallel the times when ambitious blacks or browns or reds or yellows were told they were trying to be what?
White.
Yes.
Now the Greeks said, know thyself, be thyself. You know, just, you know that.
Okay. I think that's good advice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm not suggesting that any of you know sex dolls or anything, but if you look at this image here, that is straight off of a sex doll. The face is, and the posture. And notice, this is not some small, this is not Sam's Club or Sam or Big Bob's Barbecue or something. Who is the company here? That's right. And I hated to show these images, but I show them for this reason. That Hustler magazine, some people don't believe that issue actually existed, that it's just a part of folklore or whatever. And this was Larry Flint when he kept saying, well, people keep accusing me of treating women like meat. And so he did this supposedly as satire. And often what purports to be satire is just an extension of the thing that it's purporting to satirize. On the other side, that's Tip Drill from Nelly. And I thought to myself, this was shown on BET. This was a popular video. And I thought to myself, my goodness, we have no more subtlety, no more nuance anymore. The idea of sexually objectifying and treating women as commodities, he just took it to the extreme. I'm proud of Spelman College, a historically black college, where he was going to give them a huge donation at the time this was out, and they basically said to him, keep your money. Real quickly, I'm trying to get through this. I'm a little longer than I thought. I apologize. I tell you this right here. There is a human being on this earth. What have we got, about 7 billion people? There's not a human on this earth who knows why some people are gay and some people are straight. Not one. I'm a sociologist. I know physiologists. I know geneticists. I know I've read every good theory. Nobody knows. There are theories, some with more evidence than others, some with more support than others. Not one of us knows. But this much I do know, that in a democratic and egalitarian society, you ought to treat people fairly. And it doesn't matter if you know why they are the way they are. I saw this game on CNN 3 years after we had it. The reason I found out about it is because my students were sitting in class killing Mexicans as they crossed the border. It's a video game. This one does what you expect it to do. You take him and you walk him in front of people and you blow yourself up in them. You see that picture, I guess it's on the right, in the new museum? Well, I can't say we have the pen he's using, because what he did was he used multiple pens so he could pass them out, but we have one of those pens that LBJ used to sign the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was the most comprehensive civil rights act in this country's history. I'm proud. And I tell you what, that was a whole lot easier to spend my money on than some of the other stuff. And so when we have this new facility, which 1 year from now you're all invited to come, and I'll pay your airplane tickets down, each one of you. But in that place, and this, I think this next to last slide, in that place, we're going to have this mural. And on that mural will be black people and brown people and red people and yellow people and white people who died during the Civil Rights Movement. And not just the February names. Some of the people you don't know. And we're going to sit them up there. And the reason I'm doing this is to pay homage to my grandmama. Because she was a religious woman, Pentecostal, and she always talked about the cloud of witnesses. It scared the hell out of me when I was a kid, because it was this idea that whatever you did, and my mind went right to sexual sin, but whatever you did, this cloud of witnesses was watching you. And these were out, you get where I'm going with this? And so even when you meant to do something wrong, you just kept looking over your shoulder. This kind of very African, you know, ancestral kind of thing. And in the Bible, when it talks about the cloud of witnesses, it means something a bit different, but still the same kind of concept, that we are watched by those who came before us. I want to put a mural up where these civil rights people, these activists, whether they intended to be or not, who gave their lives, martyrs, real martyrs, they watch us as we discuss not the bad stuff, but we discuss racial reconciliation and understanding and many organizations. Because the thing I have to, one of the last lessons I've learned, is that I have to spend a part of each day on my computer researching organizations and individuals who are working for racial reconciliation. Otherwise, I go the wrong way. Thank you very much.
I'm sure that Dr. Pilgrim will entertain some questions, but before that, I just actually wanted to say one thing and actually give him something. There's a video that they've made about the Jim Crow Museum, and I don't know if the whole thing, but some parts of it are on YouTube, and I showed it in my class last semester, and there's an interesting point that he makes, that most people, when they come into the Jim Crow Museum, they use different mechanisms to try to distance themselves from the material on display. They say, you know, oh, I've never seen anything like that, or, oh, that's from a long time ago, or they don't have that where I'm from, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, discussions kind of similar to that came up in my my seminar last week. And so I have a couple things, one of which actually I've had for quite a few years, and, well, since 2003, and the other one I got just about a year ago, which prove that, you know, this kind of stuff is not just from other times and places. These are things that I want to actually give to Dr. Pilgrim and donate them to the museum. I use these objects for teaching. One is it's a box that I picked up in the duty-free shop in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, in 2003 or 2004. And it contained souvenir, the small bottles of Becherovka, which is the Czech sort of national liqueur. And it has these really incredibly disturbing, very classic traditional pictures of a small black child serving, you know, with a serving serving this liquor with this, you know, crazed smile on his face and a monkey next to him. So that's one.
And I'm glad you think of me when you see stuff.
Well, actually, I didn't even know him when I picked that up, but I've been trying to figure out what to do with it, and so far the only comfortable thing is to use it as a teaching tool. But I think that, you know, we'll get much more. Much more play in his museum. And the other one I just picked up last year, I live up in Mile End, and I walked over to near the Outremont Metro, and I went to a cafe that I like to get a croissant, and I saw this sort of hot cocoa mix called Banania, which I guess is from France, but it's quite popular, and it has a, you know, racist caricature on it. And I did a little research on the web, and it's quite an old product, and just as the example with the watermelon eating girl, and then the sort of modern thing, they've softened the image over the years, but you can really see the genealogy of the image. And so this is something that, you know, I guess many of us here in Montreal maybe eat and use every day. So I just wanted to thank you very much for your talk, and I wanted to donate these to the museum. And I'm sure we'll have questions for Dr. Pilgrim.
Well, first of all, thank you, because you just kept me, remember I was telling you that I've never been to a city without getting something? But it's never been someone giving it to me. It's always been me having to go out and buy it. And I almost made it out of Montreal without finding something. So that's great, you know. Thank you very much. Do I get a hug?
Sure.
This shoulder hurts, so this shoulder hurts. Thank you. That was an appropriate hug. That's kind of a vice president of diversity and inclusion hug. Yes, sir.
We'd all like to believe that prejudice can be overcome, yet you yourself pointed out that the borderline everyday objects often provoke rationalization, belittlement, justification, all kinds of excuses that tend to work against improvement. So what does one then do with these people? And they are far more numerous than we'd like to believe.
Well, first of all, today is not a good day for me to be optimistic, because we went to the Holocaust Museum just before this. And so that put me in a not great space mentally. But what I will tell you is this. When I get really cynical, again, what I do is I go out and look at all the people that are doing good work, and I focus on them. But the second part is this. I look at crowds, not because I don't just speak to colleges, I speak to a lot of different groups. And when I show some images like what I showed, and I see the repulsion on their faces, that is a weird but effective measure of the progress we've made. Because had I shown some of these images 40 years ago, I would not have gotten the same kinds of responses. And so what I'm saying is I think that although there are people who are locked into where they are and don't want to begin the journey that they would need to get to a certain place, that they are now in the minority, and that if we haven't gotten to a tipping point, we're certainly very close to it. And so for me, what I choose to do is to try to focus on the rest of us as we work with some others. But I've reconciled myself to, you know, I had a guy tell me once, he says, listen, you know, you think you're smart and you got a little silver tongue on you, but you ain't changing me. And I said, that's okay, except I already did, because we just got done talking. And that's a change in your life. So I believe in sustained dialogue. I believe in the triumph of dialogue, and I believe in education. And if I didn't believe in those things, I couldn't be an educator. So what I would suggest then is, you know, that there has been a lot of progress, maybe more than we point to, and that when we feel a little low as activists, we just need to highlight the fact that the progress does exist.
Like, there's been great artists like Picasso. He said, he first said, I'll learn to paint and unpaint. That means he learned the techniques, and then he deprogrammed himself on what was necessary, like getting rid of the prejudices and looking within your own mind and heart and getting rid of your own prejudices, maybe before you go out and try and change the whole world.
Well, and that's a brilliant point. I had prejudices against gays growing up and against women and didn't know either one. It wasn't until I went to the Ohio State University and really started, first of all, most of my teachers were women there. Mm-hmm. I did not realize the impact that growing up in that culture, this, I would be almost dignifying it by calling it a machismo. It was that in its worst elements. I didn't realize how much of that had gotten into me. Mm-hmm. And what it meant was, is stopping. And in an intentional way dealing with that. The same thing with attitudes toward gays. I mean, now, I'm pretty sure everybody in my school thinks I'm gay. Because, you know, we have, as Chief Diversity Officer, I have made it clear to the administration, the faculty, and to the students, we will be a campus that is welcoming and inclusive for everybody. And right now, that means we need to focus on the fact that we are not that, for lesbians, gays, bisexual, transgender people. That's not who I was 30 years ago. I say that neither bragging or complaining. I'm simply saying that you're right. We all need to grow. And some of us, it is with attitudes about race. Some of it is attitudes about some ethnicity or the group I started with. You know, I know some really progressive people that treat folk with disabilities, you know, as lessers. I know people that are minority groups who treat, first of all, each other or one another, forgive my English, was sleeping that day, who treat each other with disrespect. And, you know, you look at groups like poor whites. We often treat poor whites like we do racial minorities. We do that polarizing silliness where they're either the Waltons, you know, Christian, hardworking, patriotic, don't know when to stop saying goodnight, all the way to like the people from Deliverance. You understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that looks very parallel to racial stuff. So yes, you're right. We all have something to work on. And that is both the challenge and the problem. I mean, that's both the problem and the promise. The fact that a lot of it does start here. And here's the part that's a real kicker for college students. Everything about college is teaching you that to ameliorate social problems is all up here. And everything about what I've seen is that it can't just be this. It has to also be this. It has to be about relationships. They didn't teach me that at Ohio State. I mean, the stuff I got from there, I mean, some of the most brilliant theories about race relations and spatial dimensions and the impact of economics and the impact of all this other stuff, no one talked about relationships. And in terms of fixing local places, they have to be fixed locally, and the way to do that is small groups having sustained, honest dialogue.
That kind of reminds me of Da Vinci had, you know, Da Vinci's painting was not... According to some people, Jesus was around a round table. Everyone was equal around that table. Mm-hmm. And in Native American spirituality, the medicine wheel, it's a circular thing. And all the four races are equal. There's no superiority. Mm-hmm. Everyone is equal. Mm-hmm. There's no.
I was just wondering, relating a bit to what you just mentioned, on the news recently, I think it was Huckleberry Finn or one of the classic novels, they were discussing perhaps changing the N-word or other racially sensitive issues so that people in, I guess, high schools or young kids can read it. Do you feel that this kind of hinders the, because it's you're essentially kind of diluting the context, do you think that would be detrimental or beneficial? And if, and how would that kind of change the significance of the message you're trying to portray. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the way I've approached that is this right here. First of all, it was a single professor with a single contract, and he got his 15 minutes, you know, and it's just one person. The reason I say single is because it's not like they're going to go and white out all the books, right? I mean, there's lots of Huck Finn books out there, and there'll be many more printed. So it was a single professor, and I think the book run was like, what was it, like 800? I mean, it wasn't a large book run or anything. But having said that, I mean, and I understand his point, which was I can't get people to read it, and I can't get African Americans to read it because when they see the word, they stop reading it. And it's great fiction, and we want them to read the story and the like. My thing is this: it'd be hypocritical of me to say that you should change that book in this regard because A, we have the book and we teach it in the way it was. But I also think it's necessary to keep it. It's a historical piece. It's not just literature. It's a historical piece, and so we should understand it as it is. But for us, it's a great dialogue because now we can have the original and we can have this, and it gives us a more stuff to talk about. So I like that. No, I wouldn't. I mean, I do know it's uncomfortable when you're in a classroom. Let's say you're the only black person or brown person or red person, whatever. Or you're just a person who's, you know, sympathetic, right? And you're in a classroom, and every time one of your classmates who's, you know, 16 years old and showing off, every time they read a passage from it, they go, and then, nigga Jim, you know, I guess or whatever. Of course, you'd hope teachers would do a good job putting stuff in context and having some management skills in a classroom, but not all do, right? But if you're asking me, like, am I for taking words out of books and changing? No. No, I'm not. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering if in your museum you have any signs or advertising for those exhibits in the United States between about 1900 and 1915 or so that showed that advertised zoos which had exhibits of African people living as if they were in villages, kind of associated with the idea that Africans were just another kind of animal to be exhibited in a zoo. I first found out about it when scholars looking at German society in the early 1900s and right into the 1920s and 30s pointed out that some German zoos exhibited African people. And then it turned out, in fact, that in St. Louis at the International